A dead monk lies beneath abbey walls, his body twisted in the snow. The year is 1327, and within the stone corridors of a wealthy Italian monastery, knowledge itself has become lethal. What unfolds is not merely a medieval murder mystery, but a profound meditation on the dangerous seduction of certainty, the subversive power of laughter, and the eternal question, who gets to decide what truths we're allowed to know? This is the world of Umberto Eco's masterpiece, where a Franciscan friar named William of Baskerville, part Sherlock Holmes, part philosopher, must solve a series of deaths that all lead back to a single forbidden book hidden in the greatest library in Christendom. The Abbey's edificium stands like a fortress of knowledge, octagonal, seven-towered, deliberately designed to confuse. Unlike modern libraries built for access, this medieval repository functions as an intellectual maze. Only the librarian knows its secrets, guarding them with religious fervor. When William first demonstrates his brilliance by describing a horse he's never seen, reading broken twigs and hoofprints like a text, we understand we're witnessing a revolutionary thinker in an age that distrusts observation over divine revelation. The library's 56 rooms mirror the known world, books shelved by geography rather than subject. Distorting mirrors create phantoms, ventilation systems whisper like ghosts, herbs burned in censers induce hallucinations in unauthorized visitors. When young Adso becomes separated from William during their nighttime exploration, he experiences visions so terrifying they blur reality and nightmare. The physical labyrinth mirrors the intellectual one, knowledge compartmentalized, hierarchical, available only to the worthy. A library is not an instrument to distribute the truth, William explains, but to delay its appearance. This revelation shatters Adso's naive faith that wisdom naturally flows to seekers. Behind the murders lurks a theological dispute with explosive political implications. Did Jesus own property? The question sounds arcane until you realize what's at stake, the legitimacy of the church's vast wealth and temporal power. Franciscans arguing for apostolic poverty threaten the entire medieval order. Pope John XXII has declared their position heretical, not because it's theologically unsound, but because it's politically dangerous. William arrives to prepare for a debate between papal and Franciscan theologians, but Bernard Guy, a ruthless Dominican inquisitor, transforms intellectual discourse into a witch hunt. Bernard connects the murders to past heresies, arresting men likely innocent of killing, but guilty of once following radical movements. The theological debate descends into accusation and insult, truth becoming secondary to political advantage. William, caught between competing powers, compares himself to an ass who does not know which of two sacks of hay to eat. Abstract philosophy becomes a weapon. Disputes about divine truth serve as proxies for earthly struggles over wealth and control. As bodies accumulate, a pattern emerges. All victims accessed a mysterious text that blind monk Jorge of Burgos will kill to keep hidden. The book proves to be Aristotle's lost treatise on comedy, and Jorge's fear reveals power's relationship to humor. Laughter frees the villain from fear of the devil, Jorge argues, because in the Feast of Fools, the devil also appears poor and foolish, and therefore controllable. If peasants laugh at their fears, they might question everything, the social hierarchy, religious authority, the entire medieval order built on awe and terror. Throughout the Abbey scriptorium, illuminators create marginalia featuring comical inversions, hares hunting dogs, monkeys performing mass. These Bawin represent a carnivalesque tradition that temporarily flips the world upside down. Jorge condemns them as perversions, others defend them as legitimate expressions of God's diverse creation. William counters with a radical proposition. Perhaps the mission of those who love mankind is to make people laugh at the truth, to make truth laugh. This debate cuts to the heart of how societies maintain control, through fear or freedom, through rigid certainty or open inquiry. In the Abbey kitchen's darkness, young Adso encounters a nameless peasant girl, and his world of religious certainty collides with raw desire. The scene unfolds with visceral immediacy, the smell of dying embers, the warmth of skin, biblical verses racing through his mind as his body responds to something older than scripture. Afterward, shame and desire war within him as he quotes the Song of Songs, desperately reconciling sacred and profane love. When Bernard Guy arrests the girl as a witch, Adso's powerlessness reveals medieval authorities' cruel machinery. Despite his education and monastic position, he cannot save her. She remains deliberately nameless, representing countless voiceless masses crushed by theological disputes conducted far above their station. Her fate shows how abstract debates about Christ's poverty have brutal consequences for those at the intersection of gender, poverty, and illiteracy. Adso's sexual awakening parallels his intellectual development. Both force him to confront how messy human experience defies systematic thought, how neither body nor knowledge submits fully to theological control. William finally penetrates the Finis Africae to find Jorge consuming pages of the poisoned Aristotle manuscript, literally devouring the forbidden knowledge he's guarded for decades. In their struggle, fire ignites, spreading through the labyrinth with unstoppable hunger. Centuries of accumulated wisdom become ash. The greatest library in Christendom transforms into an inferno, fulfilling the apocalyptic prophecies that have threaded through the narrative, each murder echoing the seven trumpets of Revelation. But the real revelation is William's final understanding. There was no grand conspiracy, no master plan. Only accidents, individual choices, and human fears connected by a poisoned book. His elaborate theories about patterns and hidden meanings were projections of his own rational mind seeking order in chaos. I behaved stubbornly, pursuing a semblance of order, when I should have known well that there is no order in the universe, he confesses. Despite his brilliance, he could not fully comprehend the chaotic interplay of human motives and chance. The medieval world's desire for perfect order crashes against reality's complexity. Decades later, an elderly Adso collects manuscript fragments that survived the fire, a lesser library, symbolizing the fragmentary nature of all human knowledge. The novel ends with its famous line, "Stat rosa pristina nomine, nomina nuda tenemus." The rose of old exists only in its name. We possess only naked names. We never directly access reality or truth, only the symbols we use to represent them. This medieval labyrinth offers not escape, but mirror. We too navigate complex systems of signs, struggle with reason's limits, and confront those who would control knowledge for power. Jorge's desperate attempt to preserve sacred truth through censorship ultimately destroys what he sought to protect, a paradox echoing from Alexandria's burning to modern cultural destruction. In our era of information overload and competing truth claims, the novel's wisdom resonates. Absolute truth may be elusive, but the pursuit of understanding through both faith and reason remains vital. The rose exists only in its name, yet that name continues to bloom in our imagination. We must navigate between extremes, accepting that some questions remain perpetually unresolved. The search for meaning, however partial and imperfect, remains our most distinctly human endeavor.